Hello, and welcome to Word Theatre Weekly, where each Saturday we share stories from our archive of performances of the world's best short stories recorded live in Los Angeles, New York, and London, brought to life by great actors with the writers in the room. I'm your host, Word Theatre's founder and artistic director, Cedaring Fox. Please note that Word Theatre holds the copyright to these recordings, so no portion of anything you hear may be reproduced without permission. We had the great pleasure of connecting with Dan Shaun, the author of this week's stories. This supremely gifted writer is able to write about grief and heartbreak so eloquently that I, for one, am a huge fan. The two stories we are presenting today are dark, beautiful, and superbly acted. Dan is not a big talker, but he's a brilliant writer, and we got him to introduce his stories. Here now is Dan Shaun.
Welcome to Word Theatre Weekly. This is Dan Shaun, and I'm so happy that you'll be listening to two of my stories today. First up, That's Him, That's the Guy, read to you by Juliana Margulies and Raul Castillo. Second, Take This, Brother, May It Serve You Well, read by Xander Berkeley. That's Him, That's the Guy is a kind of ghost story, read for the first time by Raul Castillo and Juliana Margulies at the 20th anniversary of Word Theatre in New York City. I hope you like it as much as I do.
Our father died when we were 10 years old. And for months afterward, my twin sister Helen and I thought we saw him. We thought we saw him standing in the snow in the yard at night, but it was just a tree. We thought we saw him coming down the stairs in the morning, but it was just sunlight in the windows on the landing. We thought we heard him scritching in the garden behind the house, moving through the rhubarb along the garage. A raccoon. We were really close for a while in those years that followed his death. Afterwards, not so much. Once she became a teenager, she developed an uncontrollable attraction to these really awful guys. One after another, all through high school. And I tried to warn her and give her good advice, but she never listened. Finally, when we were seniors, she ended up getting pregnant. The boyfriend was a 25-year-old guy who worked on the road crew of our town's maintenance department. And he was married.
But getting a divorce.
She claimed. And I told her that it seemed obvious that she ought to get an abortion. Instead, she moved in with him. She gave birth to her little love child, and eventually, I heard, she and the boyfriend finally wed. Meanwhile, I had left town. I went to college. I moved down to Chicago, and then to Santa Fe, and then to Spokane. I wasn't having a great life or anything, but I thought of my family less and less. At first, when I stopped talking to my mom and my sister, I used to have these terrible guilt dreams, like I had killed them or was accused of killing them, and I was on the lam. In the dreams, I was always paranoid. In the dreams, I would walk into a convenience store or a roadside restaurant, and suddenly, one of the patrons would recognize me from a wanted poster. "That's him! That's the guy!" Someone would shout, and everyone would turn and look, and I would try to escape, even though I knew it was hopeless. And then 20 years had passed. I was the same age that my father had been when he died. There's a stage that you reach, I think, sometime in early middle age, when you begin to think of your former selves as characters, as if you had once portrayed them in school theater productions. The old hurts and resentments seem vaguely embarrassing. Why not call her, I thought. So much time has gone by. Is there any reason left to bear a grudge? I was in Minneapolis on a business trip when I decided to try it. I knew that she didn't live that far away, and there was a possibility that we could meet if things went well. But I wasn't counting on anything either. I was sitting there in my jockey shorts and a non-smoking King at the Marriott with the TV on mute, holding the ragged phone book that I'd found in a dresser drawer. When someone picked up the phone, I wasn't sure if it was my sister's voice. "Hello?" I said. And the woman's voice echoed.
"Hello?"
She said back. "I'm trying to reach Helen," I said. And then the line grew so silent that for a second, I thought she might have hung up. "Helen?" I said. And at last I heard her breath shiver.
"Dad?"
she whispered, her voice trembling like a woman who had finally seen a real ghost.
"Daddy?"
she said.
The next story, "Take This Brother, May It Serve You Well," is set in the streets of Portland, and it's read by Xander Berkeley. Xander's performance in Santa Monica blew us all away with its complexity. I'm excited for you to hear it.
Sitting in the bar of the Heathman Hotel in Portland, Oregon, early May, here is Dave Deagle peering from the foggy window as a chill rain falls on the metal patio furniture outside, and a skinny red-haired kid in a beef-eater costume, apparently the doorman, is opening a taxi and extending an umbrella to an alarmed-looking businesswoman. "What's up with the beef-eater costume?" Dave Deagle wonders, and decides that he will allow himself two glasses of beer. He is lonely, and so he decides it is okay to bestow a little indulgence upon himself. This is one of those situations, he thinks, fairly dire situations in which the Deagle of the past, the former Deagle, is allowed a certain amount of leverage. The Deagle of the past is the Deagle who managed to become the victim of a heart attack at the age of 39. It was a minor heart attack, but it still hurt quite badly, and he collapsed on the sidewalk outside his building while having a cigarette with some secretaries. Totally humiliating. And of course, it was scary, the proximity to death, the approach of death, etc. He found himself in the hospital where his bad habits were cataloged with grave disapproval. He was a lifelong smoker, for example, and a heavy drinker, and a glutton. Along with his poor heart, his lungs were blackened, his liver was growing fatty. He was, in general, out of shape and obese, the word used by a very smug and judgmental prick of a doctor. Nevertheless, the prick MD had a point. The Deagle of the past recognized that changes needed to be made, and so thus, in fact, the Deagle of the present has tackled these issues head on. Without a complaint, it might be added. Still, the beer is a pleasant treat. Deagle pats his perspiring brow with a napkin, then lips the foam off the rim of the glass. He feels lonely. He knows no one in Portland, and upon the streets there appeared to be nothing but fairly unpleasant-looking people. There was a kind of keep-on-trucking West Coast vibe at work here. And he's listed in his notepad a few passers-by. Aging hippie man, possibly stoned or homeless, wearing a stocking cap over long braids. Asian woman with a small flower tattoo upon cheek. 50-ish motorcycle babe in red heels and black leather escorting a guy who appears to be in the middle stages of multiple sclerosis. Three slightly somewhat punk in their dress. Do people use the term punk anymore? He crosses out the word and then rewrites it with three question marks after it. There are a great number of what appear to be teenage runaways, but in Portland, it seems that even the elderly dress as if they were teenage runaways, in hoodies and kerchiefs and ragged jeans, stinking of patchouli and dirty feet. And one tattooed old man even rolls by on a skateboard. My God, Dave Deagle thinks. He is lonely. There are no friends, only strangers wherever he goes, and it seems a little impossible for him to try to fit in anywhere at this point. Age 40, already a widower, already the victim of a heart attack. He stares down into the golden reflecting pool of his beer upon which floats the final remnants of foam. He really wants a cigarette. In the drugstore down the street, Dave Deagle finds himself pondering the evolution of the American pharmacy. Once there was a venerable corner drugstore. Now there are nothing but these massive chain stores, Walgreens, Rite Aid, Eckerd, etc. How exactly did we, as a country, arrive at the concept of the sort of place that he is now standing in? This brightly lit bazaar of random items, vast warehouse crammed full of aisles, each aisle with its own theme. Cold remedies, ladies' toilette, shampoos, soaps, and hair products, baby needs, tooth care, maladies of the foot, problems of the bowel, candy, weight loss. Seasonal items, in this case Easter, though past, is still being represented by rabbits, chicks, eggs, etc. No doubt someone could research this phenomenon and write an interesting article. What kind of cigarettes do you have here today? Deagle asks the unsmiling young woman behind the counter, and she raises her sullen gaze as if her eyes were weapons she is training upon him. All kinds, she says. Hateful Portlandians. Can't anyone give a poor, lonely, middle-aged fat man a friendly smile? What's the favorite of the day? Deagle continues, teasing hopefully. What's the best tasting? She does not answer. She just looks off to the side, peers around over Deagle's shoulder, and he is aware that if there were someone standing behind him in line, they would have been beckoned forward. He would have simply lost his place. But there is no one else in line. And so they stand there for a moment. Impasse. Who will be the first to blink? I guess, Deagle says, finally, I'll just have a pack of Marlboro Lights. That's what I used to smoke when I was human. Girl doesn't respond to this either. She merely turns, lifts a pack of cigarettes from the rack behind, and sets the pack upon the counter and recites a mind-boggling price. For one pack? Exclaims Deagle. Yes, says the girl. I'm outraged, says Deagle. Do you want the cigarettes or not? The girl asks. Yes, Deagle says. Yes, I do. Oh, I should have bought an umbrella in the drugstore, he realizes when he gets outside, for now the rain is coming down more determinedly. He doesn't want to give any more of his money to the unfriendly drugstore and their sour employees. He undoes the cellophane wrapper of the cigarettes and then has a terrible realization. No lighter, no matches. Arr! He cries aloud, and his anguished cry echoes against the sides of buildings, the sound bouncing back and forth and shrinking at last to a whisper, imperceptible to human ears. Down the block, the road dips downward from the Heathman Hotel towards some neon signs that are very likely to be bars. A good place to find matches. And so Deagle begins a kind of lumbering run in this direction, down the hill, very undignified, his large, shiny, black Oxford shoes slapping through puddles on the sidewalk, his heart quickening. How many years since he actually ran? Now there's a question. By the time he gets to the door of the bar, his glasses have steamed up from heavy breathing. Inside, it's surprisingly empty, but does the bartender turn to look at Deagle with an expression of welcome? A cheerful countenance? Shockingly, no. Bartender turns to Deagle with a face as blank as a thumb. Beautiful weather you people are having, Deagle says. He tries to smile, though he is sopping wet. Yeah, the bartender says. He observes as Deagle approaches a bar stool, as Deagle struggles heavily onto the perch, out of breath. God, he's so overweight, it's very unfair. Is this a way to treat visitors to your city? Deagle complains. Torrential rain? Sorry, the bartender says. I actually don't make the weather. He regards Deagle with his necklace, thumb-like head, a balding young man, perhaps 30 years of age. Well, Deagle says, how about a free drink then? He's trying to get a comic sort of banter started with this person, though already he sees it's likely to be pointless. I'm a dying man. I don't have long to live. That's too bad, the bartender says, but we don't serve free drinks. Of course you don't, Deagle says. He takes out his wallet and puts a damp 20 on the surface of the bar. How about a local beer, he says, and maybe a glass of scotch on the side. He glances around. Beside himself, there are perhaps five other patrons, all men. He imagines briefly the possibility of a lady, a kindly, haggardly woman with a drinking problem, sitting there smoking and hoping for a guy to come by and purchase a beverage for her. But there is no such person. God, he is lonely. Even a woman with a hare lip or some other deformity would be suitable. Anyone with an ounce of kindness, an ounce of compassion, such is all he asks. Is that so much? He sits there humbly upon the bar stool and watches the hand of the bartender deliver a drink before him. He raises it to his mouth, closes his eyes, swallows. Cheers. A shot, Deagle says. Bartender, may I have a shot of tequila, please? He lifts his head and some time has passed, and the bartender's distributed a few more shots. For a time, Deagle was moodily engaged in some memories, his frugal childhood in rural Minnesota, his growth as an intelligent, an ambitious high school student, triumphant college years, top 25 of his class at law school, his wedding, the birth of his two beautiful children, His career sort of taking off and advancing at an acceptable pace. All of this fairly much ruined and rendered meaningless now. Nel mezzo del cammin di nostra vita, mi ritrovo per una selva oscura, c'è la dritta via era smarrita, etc., etc. There is a stage you reach, Diggle thinks, a time somewhere in early middle age when your past ceases to be about yourself. Your connection to your former life is like a dream or delirium, and that person you once were is merely a fond acquaintance or a beloved character from a storybook. This is how memory becomes nostalgia. They are two very different things, the same way that a person is different from a photograph of a person. As time has accumulated, 1 year since the heart attack, oops, 2 years since his children went away, went to live with his sister in Mankato, 3 years since his wife's death, he has been aware of a certain degree of suicidal ideation. He will fly out on these trips under the auspices of Saunders, Dearman, and Dorr. He'll arrive at the hotel, keep his receipts with an awareness of his per diem, and yet there is also the thought that he might not return. There is a round-trip ticket, but what if he doesn't appear at the airport on the day he's supposed to go home? What if he's never seen or heard from again? What would remain? He can't help but think of the Hobblers. When his wife was sick, when she was in her last days, he used to see them moving down the sidewalk past his house, this dreadful old couple out for their evening constitutional. They must have been in their 80s or 90s, easily 40 years older than Deagle and his wife. And by the time they made it past the neighbor's driveway to the Deagles, some of the leaves of the trees had turned from green to red. "You're so mean," Deagle's wife said. "Don't make fun," she said. "I think they're sweet." Deagle didn't say anything. Maybe they were sweet, inspirational in their way, but he still didn't like them. That Hobbler wife with her bowed, osteoporotic back staring downward loomingly. The Hobbler husband, dazed and batty-looking in his tweed jacket over a pajama shirt, his hand on his wife's elbow as if escorting her to a formal dance. Deagle's wife had heard that he was an emeritus professor, physics, psychology, she couldn't remember. You could say that they were sweet, or you could say that they were something out of a horror movie. This was September, and his wife was dying pretty rapidly. She had about a month or so to go. Cancer had started in her ovaries, but now it was everywhere, and he'd reached the stage where her lungs kept filling up with fluid, a kind of slow-motion drowning. And every few days, Deagle and his wife would go in for a lung tap, which provided a little short-term relief. Deagle's wife could still make it up and down the stairs, though it took a while. They were having a lot of quiet time together. Deagle had taken time away from work, and the children were spending the fall at his sister's house. And in some ways, it was like a kind of vacation for both of them. The days had begun to waver, lose their shape. Looking out the window, reading books aloud, he drove down the hill to buy her some lemon gelato. He cooked a chicken in a pot and brought her the broth in a small bowl. Here was one of those wonderful spoons that they'd stolen from a Chinese restaurant, and he lifted it to her lips. She didn't make it long enough to see the first snowfall. And by the time the hobblers had vanished as well. The sidewalks were probably too slick for them, too treacherous. The cold air too hard on their old bones. Would run right through them. They'd feel as if they'd never be warm again. Sitting there, Deagle thought that perhaps they'd emerge again in spring. Late April, early May. Tulips and daffodils and lilacs and budding trees. He wondered if that would make her happy, to know that the hobblers were still around. Down the block and back, down the block and back. Getting a little exercise, maybe, probably, she would like it. Sweet, she would say. As for Deagle, he didn't know what he would prefer. He would sit at the window peering out, and he didn't know whether he wanted to see them or if he hoped that they would never come again. Outside the pathetic bar, under an awning, Deagle lights a cigarette and takes out his notepad, examining his notes. Beefeater, he has written. And keep on truckin' West Coast vibe. And punk? And takes out his special pen and writes, hobblers? And circles it. Was there a way to make sense of it, he wondered? Or was it like so many of the things he thought about, just another random flight of fancy? A fat raindrop falls from above and makes a splattered Rorschach out of the word punk. And so he's compelled to quickly close the notepad, tuck it into the pocket of his suit jacket. He focuses again on the cigarette. He'd forgotten the way the filters of Marlboro Lights would adhere to the skin of your lip. But the smoke itself was a pleasant sensation. And it expels itself into the Portland air, which is as heavy and dewy as fog. Back in Minnesota, when he was an undergraduate student, Deagle had taken a class in poetry writing. The teacher was an evil, judgmental old hippie with a long neck that she swathed in scarves. And her lessons were disconnected rambles that usually ended with some liberal parable about the plight of women, people of color, etc. And her comments about his poems had been vaguely rude and dismissive. Nevertheless, he had enjoyed the semester-long assignment that she had given, which required them to carry a notebook with them everywhere. Record your observations, she said. Nothing is small enough to escape the poet's notice. And here he was, still carrying his notepad, after all these years. His wife used to like reading the notepads once upon a time, though sometimes she would shake her head over a particularly acidic observation. You shouldn't be so cynical and morbid, she told him once. It's not good for your health. Though, of course, her optimism had done her little good. No wise or hopeful thoughts came to her at the end. Only a kind of pained, puzzled, childlike mumbling, last words that even he can't bring himself to write down. Maybe someday, he thinks, he might eventually expound on these little notes, and maybe someday, after his death, his heirs will uncover his cachet of unwritten poems and somehow interpret the jotted fragments, the raindropped blurs, somehow finding buried within the essence of Deagle, the stubbed out nub of himself. Such maudlin thoughts are not his usual mode. That is the Deagle of the past, he reminds himself. The former Deagle used to read sad poetry at night, drinking scotch and weeping distractedly and accidentally dropping lit cigarettes on the carpet of his study, luckily not burning the house down. The former Deagle would buy canisters of cake frosting, eat them while sitting alone in his car in a parking lot. The former Deagle popped little 10-milligram desoxin pills in between meetings with clients and then drove home and faced his unnerved Uruguayan housekeeper and then broke down. while reading The Runaway Bunny to his children at bedtime, tears rolling down his face while the kids sat frightened in their pajamas. Falling down the stairs a couple of times in the night. Drunkenly peeing on people's flowers as he walked home from the bar. Once nearly running a slow driver off the road and giving her the middle finger as she roared past. Smoking his way steadily towards his heart attack. Toward the grim, pharisaic face of his sister in his hospital room. "Those children can't be living with you," she was saying. "My God, David, there is a difference between grief and monstrous selfishness," she said. And he agreed with her. "Absolutely," he said. "You should take them. That's a great idea. Just until you get your act together," she said. "You've got responsibilities," she said. "Do you think this is how Laura would have wanted you to behave?" she said. "Don't you think she would have expected more out of you? I think she believed she married a decent human being." "Yes," he said. Obviously, he had to remake himself. Obviously, a new Deagle had to be born. His life and his pathway through it had to be rethought and reimagined and rewired. There are little wisps of jelly in a living brain. Deagle knows this well. Neurons transmitting signals. And the soul, so to speak, is somewhere in those flashes. He heard once on a science program that the spindle cell, present in humans, whales, some apes, elephants, may be at the heart of what we call ourselves. What we recognize in the mirror, that thread we follow through time that we call me, it's just a diatom, a paramecium, a bit of ganglia that branches and shudders assertively, a brief brain orgasm like lightning. In short, it's all chemicals. You can regiment it easily enough. Fluoxetine, serotonin, paroxetine, escitalopram, citalopram. The brain cells can be washed clean, and you can reset yourself. Control plus Alt plus Delete. You don't have to be a prisoner of your memories and emotions. Vials of such curatives can be found back in the Heathman Hotel, in a room, in a suitcase, in a zippered plastic bag, though that seems very far away at this point. In a distant universe, there is a good Deagle who takes his medication with a glass of water, who slips between crisp, bleached sheets and rests his head on an ergonomic pillow, who sets his alarm in preparation for the next morning's arbitration hearing and awakens bright-eyed. Still, he has to admit, being this drunk is a pleasant treat. It's been well over a year since the last time he was this loaded. But he slips into it easily, like a nice pair of galoshes and an overcoat. He'd always been something of a lush for most of his adult life, and his wife hadn't minded it, really. She had tolerated it, at least, in the way she tolerated his smoking, and had even sometimes found him endearing or amusing when he was a little lit up. Of course, now things are different. Now drinking is a private activity. Deagle, party of one. And when he's drunk or high, it seems as if he expands somehow. There's a kind of self-communion, as if he's grown a second head. A Siamese twin who will laugh at his jokes and commiserate with his sorrows and chat agreeably about his cynical and morbid observations. Or else it's the opposite. Maybe it's simply that drunkenness reduces some unwanted piece of himself, irradiates it, like a malignant growth. In either case, Deagle eases down the sidewalk, enjoying the gloam of long-absent alcohol through his blood, and visiting another unfriendly bar, and then moving along, ever hopeful, toward the next. Which, irritatingly, does not appear. He walks a little further, and then after a few more blocks, he pauses. God, how long has he been out here on the street in the rain, talking to himself? It actually seems as if he'd been walking for a while. His shoes and socks are full of rain, and his hair drips in tendrils down his face, and clusters of wet humanity regard him as he goes. Back, says Deagle, when a shambling pile of rags rises up on two legs out of the shadows to ask him for a cigarette. Back, he says, and makes a cross with his two index fingers. And in the meantime, he has no idea where he is. On his BlackBerry cell phone, he has a program with a global positioning system and satellite-guided maps, but it appears that the battery on the phone is dead. When he tries to turn it on, it plays sweetly melancholic bar of notes, the sound of polite regret. Then it goes black. When he looks over his shoulder, the landscape is utterly unfamiliar. How far in the distance is the Heathman Hotel? And what direction? He has no clue. This is a predicament, says Deagle to Deagle. He stands there frowning, cursing his reliance on technology and his own poor sense of direction. He scopes the dark street for signs of a common payphone. He can't recall the last time he actually used one, and they may, in fact, be extinct. He's not sure. Certainly there's no sign of one on this block, where the darkened buildings have blank, unwelcoming faces of people on a subway train. No lights but street lamps spotlighting the tangled lines of rain. Hello? He calls the way you might call into a canyon to hear your echo. Would it be possible, he wonders, to backtrack to rediscover the bar, which he suspects bitterly is now closed in any case? He looks over his shoulder. Hello, he calls again. And it is a bit startling, even alarming, when a female voice responds. Hello, the female voice says from somewhere in the darkness beyond. Casually, the way a shopkeeper will greet you when you enter his store. As much as he's wished for, the ghost of his wife has never appeared to him. He has never, even despite all the drinking and drugs and medication, been the victim of a hallucination. Her face bending down to kiss his forehead, shaking her head in disappointment. No, nothing. Not the barest phantasm. So now he walks toward the sound of the voice with hopeful trepidation. It has occurred to him that the ghost of his wife might rightfully be pissed off at his behavior since her death. The figure appears at the mouth of an alleyway. It is a woman with long hair and a long raincoat that reaches almost to her ankles like a gown. Spread open above her head is a large and ancient black umbrella. Hey there, drunk man, she says in a clear, girlish voice. She might be 19 or 20. What are you looking for? She says and gives him a musing smile. Whatever it is, you're in the wrong neighborhood. She doesn't resemble Deagle's late wife in any significant way. Still, there is a lingering of suggestion, and he stumbles towards her as if he recognizes her. I beg your pardon, Deagle says. You wouldn't happen to have a cell phone that I could borrow, would you? She lets out a little laugh. It's as if he's told her a charming joke, and Deagle chuckles too, though he's not sure exactly what is funny. Still, it's the first time all night that someone's been amused by something he said. "You're soaking wet, you know that?" she says. "How much have you had to drink tonight?" "A lot, I'll bet."
"Do I know you from somewhere?" Deagle murmurs.
And she cocks her head. "I don't know. Do you?" The girl's name, she says, is Chloe. And she has lived in this city for 6 years, and she has never heard of the Heathman Hotel. "It's the little guy in front," Deagle tries to explain. "He's dressed in a costume, a beefeater. You know, like the ones you watch in the Tower of London." "You realize you're in Portland, right?" she says. She smiles softly, her gentle, thin-fingered, skeletal hand on his shoulder. "Maybe you should come with me." Were Deagle not so drunk and so melancholy, this might have given him pause. He peers uncertainly into the alleyway she has emerged from, a dim and narrow brick corridor, the walls decorated in brightly colored, uninterpretable graffiti. The rain spatters thickly against black plastic garbage bags and rusting dumpsters. A puddle contains a discarded hypodermic needle and an oozing packet of fast food mustard. Is that a doorway in the distance? "Do you want to get out of the rain or not?" Chloe says. As Deagle tries to make the wobbly alley shadows come into focus. Deagle wavers. And then he sighs. He accepts the space she offers him under her umbrella, huddling close enough to her that he can smell her scent of dry grass and copper pennies. "You're a good Samaritan," he says. "Not really," she says. He follows along unsteadily until they reach a doorway. He stumbles when they come to a stop, and she reaches out to keep him from falling, a hand on the small of his back, and my God, it is startling, such a simple kindness. Deagle is quite moved. "Is this," he says, indicating the filthy, rusted door she is wedging open. "Is this your home? You're very generous to invite me into your home." "It's my office," she says. "Ah, are you a lawyer?" "No," she says. She regards him. "Are you?" "Yes," Deagle says, unbelievably. And he pauses, realizing after a moment that this exchange is a bit non sequitur, that his hold on the train of thought isn't very firm. He gives his swimmy head a shake. "What is it that you do?" he inquires politely. "I'm a psychic," Chloe says. "I also practice tarot and palmistry." She pulls the umbrella closed with an athletic javelin thrower's thrust, and the metal door makes an exclamation as she pushes against it. "Sorry about this mess," she says. The space that opens before them appears to be a small, abandoned warehouse. It might at one point have held some shabby office cubicles. It might at another point have been a sweatshop of some. Now, though, it is more or less an indoor junkyard, piled with stacks of scrap metal, some ancient broken computers, fax machines, dot matrix printers, old filing cabinets, loops of copper wire, rotting furniture. In the center, a fire is flickering in a metal barrel. Some wheeled office chairs are arranged around it, Chloe gestures him forward. Have a seat, she says. It's warm and dry at least, she says, and Deagle wavers over a cardboard box filled with cobweb 3x5 floppy disks. It is the sort of place that he should describe in his notebook, he thinks, and he fingers his pockets uncertainly. He finds a damp packet of Marlboro Lights and his dead BlackBerry and a pen. Do you have a phone in here? Deagle says. I like to call a taxi. Chloe says nothing. She shakes the rain from her long hair and walks toward the firelight, which exudes translucent undulations of heat and greasy smoke. Deagle realizes then that there is another person in the room, a silhouette sitting in a chair near the burning barrel. And when the figure lifts its head, Deagle sees that it is a male Caucasian, wiry and shirtless, sporting a kudzu of dreadlocked hair. Deagle's heart sinks a little. He intuits that things may begin to go badly. And Chloe, psychic that she is, gives him a look as if to apologize. Have a seat, she says again. And the dreadlocked male leans forward and rests his eyes on Deagle. Deagle imagines that this caveman-like being will probably use a blunt weapon when the time comes. He imagines it'll hurt to be bludgeoned. What's up? The male says. Chloe says, this is Boomer. How you doing, customer? Says Boomer, and Deagle nods. I've been better. He says, haven't we all? Says Boomer. Deagle guesses that shortly there will be a robbery or other crime committed against his person, but he is still drunk enough that the thought disturbs him only vaguely. Like that ticklish heebie-jeebie sensation in the small of the back, the monitory intuition that something is creeping up behind you. Is there a scientific word for that, Deagle wonders? Something like deja vu? He considers writing this in his notebook, pats his pocket, but the notebook is not on his person. He feels a little zing of loss, a distant firework arcing into the night sky, but what can be done at this point? It's better, perhaps, to just sit still. He folds his hands, as he sometimes does during the many arbitration tables he finds himself at, flying here and there across the country to arbitrate labor disputes for his clients, usually pointless. But it has made him an expert at folding his hands in a peaceable and significant way. And it has also allowed him to perfect a certain kind of measured and expectant breathing. Boomer regards his performance with some interest, and the two of them sit there in silence for a time, while Chloe busies herself in some corridor of dismantled office furniture. Presently, Boomer withdraws a hand-rolled cigarette and lights it. Are you here to get your fortune told? Boomer asks. Chloe, she's pretty accurate, pretty accurate. That's good to hear, Deagle says, and stares at his hands. When you are a widower, you're supposed to move the wedding band from the left ring finger to the right. This is an etiquette or something, an old tradition, and when Deagle has removed his own ring, about a year after she died, there was a crease in the flesh below his knuckle, a little belt didn't go away. Though he massaged it and rubbed it with lotion, it seemed for a while like it would be more or less permanent. Now, however, that mark is gone. Deagle clears his throat. Actually, Deagle says, I just got lost. Lost in Portland. That's all. Word, says Boomer. Right on. When Chloe appears at last, she's no longer wearing her raincoat or her boots. She has on a tasseled shawl and a long, vaguely ethnic skirt, and her feet are bare. She does not wear a turban, Deagle is relieved to see. Though her dark hair has a gypsyish kink to it. I thought we might have some of those cheap cell phones, she says to Boomer. Those prepaid, no contract ones, you remember? What happened to those? I don't know, Boomer says. Did we sell them? Maybe, Chloe says. And then she shrugs her shoulders at Deagle regretfully. Sorry, she says. I think you're out of luck, Mr. Drunk Man. And Deagle watches as she settles herself into Boomer's lap, leaning against him, that thin hand brushing along the length of his bare arm, an absently tender gesture. You got $50? She says to Deagle. I'll read your palm for you. Most people would not believe this, but once there were happier times. A territory of years in which Deagle was surprisingly satisfied. He didn't even know it at the time, but there was an entire period in which it seemed he was going to have a nice life. He loved coming up behind his wife while she was washing dishes and putting his hands underneath her shirt to touch her warm back. He loved to ride in the car together, the ordinary drives to a cheap restaurant or a park. Four of them listening to children's music. Or speaking brightly about the things you talk to children about, his wife in the driver's seat, and him beside her, the kids snug in their car seats. Or to find her in bed, absorbed in a book, her head bent and a small private smile on her face, marking some comment in the margin, a remark to the author, to a future reader, but now indecipherable, a message only to her missing self. Or the little basket of stones and shells and flotsam she had collected. They had spent hours walking along beaches and riverbeds and hiking trails, and he loved the sweet, dreamy attention she paid to these little objects because they were pretty or interesting, choosing one over the other, using some unfathomably subtle calculation. As mysterious as the part of himself that was chosen and loved by her. The part of himself that was there only when they were together. There's $200 left in his wallet, plus credit cards, which Deagle suspects will mean more to them than they will to him. He can feel the warmth of the fire in the barrel as he passes the wallet to Boomer. Boomer grins, showing a row of nice teeth, the orthodontia some long-ago parents once paid for, only one missing. In exchange, Boomer offers a thin glass tube about the size and shape of a cigarette. He extends it nobly like a king presenting a sword to a knight. Take this, brother. May it serve you well, Boomer says. And Deagle places the tube to his lips, drawing smoke. When Boomer holds a lighter to it, and he can feel it go branching through his lungs and brain, his heart quickens. The barrel fire glows orangely. It's waves of heat like ripples in an old window pane. And he leans back as Chloe and Boomer curl in their chair together, and he loves the way they touch each other, the way she puts her lips to his ear, and the way his nail-bitten fingers absently roll the edge of her skirt up her thigh. Their two heads bending over his billfold, examining its contents like children who have opened a gift. Sweet, his wife would say. And Deagle closes his eyes. Maybe there is a time for Chloe to see what is left in his palm.
Here it is. He holds it out to her.
I'd like to take a moment to thank our generous actors for their deeply sensitive work. These performers donate their time and talents. They show up live to step into stories at Word Theater. Thank you, Raul Castillo and Juliana Margulies, for performing That's Him, That's the Guy. And thank you, Xander Berkeley, for Take This, Brother. May it serve you well. Dan Shaun is an accomplished author with 3 short story collections and 4 novels under his belt. His work has been featured in prestigious journals and anthologies such as Best American Short Stories, my favorite, the Pushcart Prize Anthologies, and the O. Henry Prize Stories. His most recent novel, Sleepwalk, was published in 2022 to much acclaim. You'll find Dan's books at bookshop.org/shop/wordtheater. His last name is spelled C-H-A-O-N. Thank you, Dan. If you're enjoying Word Theater Weekly, please tell your friends about us. And if you're anywhere near Santa Monica, California, please join us live on Friday, April 12, 2024, when Word Theater presents An Evening with George Saunders and His Stories. We have 6 great actors, 1 marvelous saxophone player, and the one and only George Saunders. Tickets are going very fast, so please visit wordtheater.org to get yours. And if you're there, come and say hello. Time to wrap it up. So I'd like to thank always philanthropist benefactor Ola Strom, Glass Animals for our theme music, the Los Angeles County Department of Arts and Culture for their ongoing support, and thank you to all our wonderful interns, including our graphics intern Yang Yang Huang, our podcast intern Riley Fox, our video intern Vincent Paz, our executive coordinator Scout Riley, and always our podcast editor Jason Lee. Hope to see you Friday, April 12th in Santa Monica for An Evening with George Saunders and His Stories. And if you live far away, just become a Word Theater member at wordtheater.org/membership, and you'll be able to stream the show later. As soon as this 3-camera shoot is edited, simply visit wordtheater.org/membership, and you'll receive perks throughout the year. Until next week, this is Cedaring Fox, signing off.